UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Welcome to the Best of UEG Week with today's topic, and a very important topic to me, oncology. My guest today is Thomas Seuferlein, the director of the Department of Medicine 1 at Ulm University in Germany and the past president of the German Congress of Cancer, and very instrumental in a number of national and international guidelines in the field of GI oncology. My name is Julia Meierle, and I'm going to be your host today. Thomas, thank you for having joined us to UEG Week in Vienna. I hope you do have enjoyed it, at least I did. Let me know, how is UEG Week for you as a starter?
Hi, Julia. First of all, thanks very much for the too kind invitation, and thanks for having me today for this very interesting podcast. I think UEG is quite interesting because it's a multidisciplinary meeting, and that's quite important because treating patients becomes more and more multidisciplinary, and we can't do without the other disciplines, being it surgery, being it radiology. So we all have to get together and really try to find the best for our patients. And that is particularly the case for oncology, but also for IBD, liver, and so on. So I think UEG is a unique meeting, and I think it's really interesting and really up to date and state of the art to do things more and more together and learn together what is new in a particular field.
I totally agree. And I think this is the idea of having a scientific committee preparing a program in a multidisciplinary fashion. And this is where we for sure have the added value of the meeting. So let's dive into the topics of UEG Week where you believe they are of great importance. I know we chatted a little bit up front. And my feeling is that you would like to tell the audience a little bit about MSI and colorectal cancer. Could you allude on that?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a revolution in this respect. And I can just start with a case which has just happened quite recently at our hospital. A 26-year-old woman, actually in the 35th week of pregnancy, was diagnosed with cancer, metastatic cancer, with peritoneal carcinomatosis, liver metastases, and on primary turned out to be from the biopsy, that's most likely from the bowel, and as it turned out to be a microsatellite instable cancer. Beforehand, it was thought, well, we have to save the baby and maybe everything to do for the baby and the mother maybe is forlorn because of this advanced disease. And we learned it's a microsatellite instable cancer, most likely related to a Lynch syndrome, a very young patient in this respect for that. And it's quite typical for this disease. And this might be actually a case where we can rescue both the baby as well as the mother. And the mother might actually survive and be healed from the disease. And this is a complete revolution we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years. Microsatellite unstable disease is about 5 to 8% of all colorectal cancers. And it's important, and we have recent data that make it really important to diagnose it as early as possible to avoid unnecessary treatments. And this means we have to diagnose it when we do the endoscopy. So when we do an endoscopy and we have an observation that's suspicious of either rectal or colon cancer, we take the biopsy, send it to pathology. We should at the same time request at least immunohistochemistry for deficient mismatch repair proteins, because that's a very easy way to assess it. It's well established in the pathology labs. We do that for ages now, and the result is quite reliable, and it can be confirmed later on by a PCR of microsatellite instability, but it's also sufficient to have the mismatch repair proteins to see whether this is there's a deficiency. Why am I saying that? We have data now in rectal cancer. This is a very small trial, only 18 patients, 14 actually fulfilling the criteria, and they had a complete clinical remission with dostarlimab, which is a PD-1 checkpoint inhibitor, treating in advance, and none of the patients required surgery so far, radiotherapy, chemotherapy. So all were, they had a complete remission, which is sustained, which is absolutely amazing. And this now is a 3-year observation period, which is quite remarkable. And we have similar data in colon cancer. There it might be less of a trouble, because in rectal cancer, usually all our interventions do have quite a few side effects. I just would like to mention LARS, for example. And it's a very sensitive area where we do either surgery or radiation. Colon cancer is less of a problem, but the niche study, for example, from Miriam Shalavi, they examined really nasty tumors, T4, N2 tumors, so advanced colon carcinomas. They also did a pre-treatment. They did a very short pre-treatment. This was just a period of 3 weeks where they did the pre-treatment, two applications of immunotherapy, nivolumab, ipilimumab, and they could show in around 70% a complete pathological response, between 60 and 70% complete pathological response. Patients were resected, which is good because then you have almost a naught recurrence rate in this respect. And what we have to also say is that these patients have a very poor response to chemotherapy. So microsatellite unstable cancers do not do well on chemo. And therefore, this might be an interesting option also for downsizing, downstaging, and then having almost no rate of local recurrence, and obviously also a low rate of distant metastasis. So knowing the state is important in the early setting. Of course, it's also important in the late setting. We have very nice data now, even in first-line immune checkpoint inhibitors in the microsatellite unstable population, does really well. And we have patients with a complete remission, even in an advanced metastatic state. I mentioned this young lady who is pregnant. This is an ideal candidate for immune checkpoint inhibitors. And we've seen patients like, it's really like a Lazarus effect, that really got cured from the disease even when they were metastatic. And we would usually treat them if they respond really well for 2 years and then discontinue treatment. And I'm having patients now, I'm observing after that period of time, tumor-free. Of course, it's not 100%. There is some heterogeneity in this group of microsatellite unstable patients, which we do not quite understand at this moment in time. But there is more work to that, and we're working also in Germany. We're trying to gather more the centers for hereditary colon cancer to really learn more and also do better molecular analysis of these patients to characterize them further, to learn more and be able to actually find better treatments for those who do not so well on immune checkpoint inhibitors. Having said that, fortunately, that's the minority of patients, not the majority, but still we want to do the best for all the patients, of course.
So just to jump in here for a second, I mean, I do understand, and I think it's a real paradigm shift that we can treat MSI tumors with checkpoint inhibitors. But would you recommend, if there's a complete pathological response, that we would still do some resection in colorectal cancer just to be on the safe side, that there is no tumor recurrence? Or would you think that the, say, medical treatment is, in a sense, organ sparing and allows us after a follow-up of 2 years or treatment of 2 years just to follow up, and the likelihood of a reoccurrence of tumor is so low that we don't need surgery?
As said, in case of rectal cancer that has more side effects due to treatment, I would, in case of a complete clinical response as determined by MRI and CT scan, maybe even PET scan and endoscopy, I would actually follow a watch and wait strategy, bearing in mind that this is no approval yet of the strategy. We have a very low number of cases at this moment in time, although it's dramatic what the response is like, but it's a very low number of cases. But in rectal cancer, we do follow also in a microsatellite stable situation after neoadjuvant treatment, a watch and wait strategy. So we do allow patients to be actually watched and surveyed without being treated by surgery, for example, when there is a complete clinical response. So in rectal cancer, I think that's a worthwhile regimen, bearing in mind it's a very low number of cases, and bearing in mind that the patient is willing to undergo a continuous surveillance, because that's important. That's also a burden for patients, because every 3 months you have to do a very extensive workup. But if the patient is prepared for that, I would go in Germany to ask insurance for coverage of this strategy, because I think it improves the quality of life. In the case of the nasty colon cancers, I would consider also not being approved as a treatment so far, also with a request to the health insurance company to be able to do downsizing, particularly when it's a T4 extensive tumor with involves surrounding tissue. But in this case, with the idea of a downsizing to actually allow a more limited resection, for example, avoiding a multivisceral resection. But in case of colon cancer, because it's less aggressive treatment for patients with lower side effects, I would still, because the data are not as perfect as they are for rectal cancer, in that case, I still would advocate for resection, but maybe if it's necessary for downsizing. If it's a T1, T2 tumor, I don't think it's necessary. But for a T4, N2, I think I would do that just to avoid complications from the extensive tumor disease.
So that brings me to the question of side effects. I mean, you said in rectal cancer, resection might be or will result in some side effects. So what about checkpoint inhibitor treatment? Does it also cause side effects which are relevant? And how long will they last after you stop treatment?
Yeah, that's an important question. And I think we learned a lot from our colleagues, the dermatologists, who gave us a lot of material to learn with from the melanoma treatment. And of course, we see with immune checkpoint inhibitors actually unleashing the autoimmune response to the tumor. We're also unleashing autoimmune responses to various other tissues like thyroid, like adrenals, like a hypophysis, like the liver or like the bowel. So we do, in general, if we're not too aggressive, so if we have a single agent treatment. In the majority of cases, we do see maybe grade 1-2, but very few grade 3-4 side effects. The majority actually has thyroid problems. We've seen that, and it's mostly an autoimmune thyroiditis that actually, first of all, has an increased and then reduced function, and patients need the substitution of thyroid hormones, but that's fairly simple to do. Some have actually adrenalitis and Addison's-like symptoms, so we have to supplement them with hydrocortisone. We see mild cases of autoimmune hepatitis. I've seen very rarely, only with the combinations then, and we do see more and more aggressive combinations, not only with checkpoint inhibitors, but also with other immune checkpoint inhibitors like LAG-3, like TIGIT, and so on. But that requires steroids. And the most serious side effect, and this is seen with a novel generation of checkpoint inhibitors, but also, for example, with CCR8 inhibitors, that's autoimmune colitis. And that can be quite difficult to treat for patients, but if you know it, it's simple because they respond, if they don't respond to steroids, they respond really well to anti-TNF-alpha antibodies. And this is why gastroenterology is nice to treat cancer patients because we, of course, are familiar also with the treatment of IBD. And therefore, our threshold to use infliximab is much lower than the threshold of an oncologist because for them, it's completely different world. For us, it's quite normal. And some patients actually can do with one single dose, and the majority of patients does well with an induction treatment, and then you can discontinue the treatment again. So that can be very well treated. In autoimmune hepatitis, it responds to steroids very well. A third to up to 40% of patients can be exposed again without any problems. In some patients, you have to discontinue treatment later on because otherwise you get a recall of the symptoms. And in the case of thyroid or adrenal problems, if there is a problem, you have to substitute the missing function. We had one case now, which is interesting, of maybe autoimmune diabetes. This was a patient with a melanoma on double checkpoint immune inhibitor treatment. In the second treatment, so it was a first-line failure, second-line with a combination treatment. And this patient had about 2 months after initiation of the combination treatment came down with diabetes and before was a completely normal glucose function. So we actually assume autoimmune diabetes. We're just checking for antibodies right now. We haven't got the results yet. But that, of course, is treated as normal with insulin in this case.
I totally agree that a infliximab or Remicade treatment is very helpful in checkpoint-induced colitis. However, maybe we would like to remind our colleagues that there are a couple of, say, analysis you have to do upfront, like you would do in IBD, which you should definitely do because otherwise you run into trouble. Do you want to comment on that?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So you do the normal checkup you would do for each and every patient with IBD. So you do the viral scan, including hepatitis. You, of course, look for tuberculosis. And so just to make sure that the treatment is safe And it's even if you only give it once or if you give it three times, you have to be sure that you're not causing trouble for the patient just by employing a treatment that may actually cause immunosuppression, therefore occurrence of tuberculosis or something like that. No, that's for sure. And you have to observe all the contraindications for these drugs as well. Absolutely. So when it occurs, what we usually do is when we see an autoimmune related colitis, we start with steroids, but we immediately take all the samples for microbiology and virology to be ready when, in case the steroids don't work and we have to use then a TNF-alpha blocker. So we have everything ready to go in this instance.
I guess we should shift gear a little bit in our podcast today. One of the side effects we do see quite often is a very severe hepatitis. And here I also see that it's sometimes it's very difficult to treat and steroids do not help. And again, then you also need to use biologicals. And I think there are perfect guidelines you all should be aware of, which can be used in this situation and which we should all adhere to. But to follow our, say, talk on not only side effects, but also how we could improve treatment in other areas of cancer, how do you think about molecular stratification and what do you think should we do in 2024? And what do you, have you learned or already knew? What have you contributed to UEG in this week in this field, Thomas?
Well, there were quite a few sessions on molecular stratification of GI cancers. And I think this was a very nice compilation of data and fantastic presenters like Jenning there talking about RAS inhibitors in pancreatic cancer. That's the new, there might be a new era coming of RAS inhibitors, which was drugging the undruggable for about 40, 50 years right now. And we never made it so far, but it seems like this is now real, for real. We can do that. We started with the G12C inhibitors, bearing in mind that G12C for is a very small proportion of the tumors in GI cancers. Between 2% in pancreatic and 4% in colorectal cancers. But the concept can be used for also G12D and G12V and also for pan-RAS inhibition. And there is quite a different portfolio now of RAS inhibitors, being it mutation-specific inhibitors, RAS-on, RAS-off inhibitors, pan-RAS inhibitors, pan-RAS-on inhibitors, pan-RAS-off inhibitors. So there will be also a variety of different options. The only downside so far we see is that there's quite a rapid development of resistance towards the concept, particularly in the G12C. We don't know about the G12D in this respect. And of course, we will probably have to combine these drugs with other drugs blocking the counteracting pathways that actually are turned on by inhibiting RAS. And we will, of course, have to learn how early we should employ these drugs. And maybe in the late metastatic setting, it's not an ideal situation where we have a really well-trained tumor. But this is a learning area. But it also might be that these drugs enable for the first time releasing immunosuppression in pancreatic cancer. We have some preclinical data that these drugs work really well in combination with checkpoint inhibitors in syngeneic mouse models, but it might be an interesting approach to turn this really cold pancreatic cancer into something at least a little bit warmer and make it accessible then also for checkpoint inhibitors. So there is, I think, quite an interesting avenue of novel strategies for pancreatic cancer. And what we should do at the moment, because the trials are running and we can't employ these drugs right now, but at the moment, what we already can do is at least differentiate in pancreatic cancer the RAS wild type from the RAS mutated situation. And in RAS mutant, so far, it doesn't really make an awful lot of sense to do exome sequencing or panel sequencing because we rarely find something in these in tumors, at least not in centers that haven't a special program on pancreatic cancer. But the RAS wild type is interesting. And once you have that, there, Archer sequencing, so RNA-seq and panel sequencing or exome, if you have it, makes sense because you have a lot of gene fusions, you have a lot of amplifications, and you have a lot of targets that are already addressable with available drugs. And so this might be, particularly in the setting of a molecular tumor board, an interesting option to find novel ways of targeting particular alterations, for example, like NRG fusions, which are mainly found in the RAS wild type population. They're also a little bit more MSI high in this population, which makes them also interesting for checkpoint inhibitors. So that's worthwhile once you have a RAS wild type to really look further or refer the patient to a center where they can do exome or panel sequencing and RNA-seq. And of course, we have CCC as another example, cholangiocarcinoma. That's a prime example of molecular stratification of tumors. And we now have in cholangiocarcinoma a variety of different targets. We differentiate the intra- and extrahepatic situation. Extrahepatic mainly with HER2 amplification, intrahepatic with a lot of different targets, but in particularly the FGFR fusions. We have also drugs now for FGFR mutations, and we have drugs now that can be sequentially used when you have target and FGF fusion, but then you have a resistance either by additional mutations or by alterations in the FGFR fusion that can be used. So there's now a variety of sequences you can employ. And of course, you have IDH1, IDH2. Mutations that also can be targeted by available drugs. So there is quite a variety in this BRAF mutations in this setting, which you can address, and that's which makes this disease quite interesting for sequencing, because and it probably it's interesting to do that up front, not only for a limited number of genes, but for a little bit more, at least for a panel of those genes I mentioned, to make sure that you can give the right treatment to the patient. This, the first-line treatment is still combination chemo plus checkpoint inhibition, but quite a few patients don't tolerate it well or progress rapidly. And then if there is a fusion, that might really make sense, because the FGFR fusions, interestingly, when you target them, they have a very nice response also. So for some patients, this might even make them resectable once there is a good response of the tumor to the FGFR inhibitor.
That's a real revolution, or? I mean, we all believe that precision medicine and the option of molecular stratification really might improve outcome of our patients. And we just have to learn a little bit more. And I think then there will be real changes to the benefit of our patients. What I don't understand right now is, talking of hepatocellular carcinoma, we know that the combination of checkpoint inhibitor therapy, be it one or two checkpoint inhibitors, in addition to anti-angiogenesis, helps a lot. However, the number of MSI patients is very low in hepatocellular carcinoma. So what are the other mechanisms which are successfully exploited here, which we cannot really name? Can you elucidate a little bit on that?
I think that's a very good question. I think it's a bit difficult and not really well understood. However, having said that, it's definitely a pro-angiogenic tumor. And therefore, you have angiogenesis inhibitors do work well, as we know with the atezobeva. And it's an inflamed tumor because you have usually a chronic inflammation in the tumor. So you have quite a few tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes in this tumor. And maybe the high number of TILs in the tumor enables the action of the checkpoint inhibitors and facilitates their action. And what I'm really surprised is, because these patients usually have two diseases, they have liver cirrhosis and a cancer, to tolerate these treatments fairly well as compared to some of the patients who do not do really well on TKIs. And we've seen quite a few with liver failure on TKIs, whereas they really tolerate very well the immune checkpoint inhibitors. But no, this is a revolution. Now we have another drug combination just been released, the Nivo-Ipi combination in liver cancer, which gives a very nice response rate. There were more fatalities in the Nivo-Ipi group, which we are not yet quite accounted for. We have to wait for the final publication, really telling us whether this was due to COVID or what the real reason was for the difference in the treatment as compared to the control group. But again, this is now that we have now a real good standard for treatment of these patients in combination with many other modalities, of course, like surgery, like local treatments with TACE and so on. But I think liver cancer has fantastically improved from being virtually untreatable about 10 years ago now to being actually a really approachable disease from various different avenues, and multimodal treatment helps a lot to our patients.
So, I mean, talking about immune therapy, checkpoint inhibitor therapy, do you see any role of CAR T cells in solid cancers? And which of the GI cancers would you target, because you believe that that concept would be more beneficial in this cancer than in another?
It's difficult because it depends a little bit on the quality of the antigen. And since we have in GI cancers usually multiple different antigens, it makes it a bit harder to identify the antigen that is the one that wins the game as compared to hematological malignancies. And there is a lot being tried. And everyone you ask doing a CAR T in a solid tumor says, this is the antigen and we can prove it. This is fantastic. And you've got to believe it. But we also know mechanisms how the tumors actually downregulate presentation of antigens. And we have so far not so many data really helping us to assess how long is the effect of such a CAR T approach. I think it's worthwhile trying, but I haven't, to be honest, there are some examples from China and HCC that look quite promising. But in other tumor entities, I haven't seen really data that pushed me off the chair. I think it just depends on the antigens, and I think we haven't found the optimal solution for that issue yet.
I totally agree, but I think it's very important that we start thinking about it so that the GI oncology field is not left behind in such an, say, interesting concept to actually move on cell-based therapies. So that brings me to my last question before maybe you would like to tell me what you would like to see next year at UEG Week. And this is, what do you think about vaccination strategies? I mean, the BioNTech trials, other indication, is there anything you would advocate for?
No, I think that's also a fantastic and a very interesting novel strategy, particularly for difficult to treat tumors and with particular personalized vaccines that are made from the tumor, which is quite interesting. And it's a huge endeavor to make these vaccines. And we see that, at least judged by the available data, which are very, very little, half of the patients do seem to benefit dramatically. The other half doesn't. And we don't quite know why that is, that some actually mount a T-cell response and others don't, although the antigen preparation's been quite similar. But of course, there will be more data on that as well, and maybe there are ways around. So far, there are people saying also with peptide vaccination, we heard a very interesting talk by Julia Levals from Tübingen at UEG, there could be also approaches taking that strategy not only in the adjuvant situation with a low tumor load, but also in situations with a higher tumor load in the metastatic situations. And there are case reports that show that some patients can even respond in a metastatic situation to maybe a RAS-directed vaccine, which I found quite interesting, that it works. The mechanisms are, to me at least, a bit unclear why it works in some and it doesn't in others. But I think that we're learning more and more, and there are different approaches with warehouse-based approaches compared to individualized approaches that are taken forward. And I think there will be more to come in the coming years. And this is, a flourishing area. It's been a little bit under the carpet for quite a few years because there was not so much progress. But now with novel algorithms and also AI identifying neoantigens, identifying novel strategies and peptides to use for vaccination, I think there might be a major progress also in the years to come.
So what do you wish for in UEG Week 2025 in Berlin? Anything you want to let the scientific committee know that we shouldn't miss it?
I think it would be interesting to really focus on novel strategies and really get also the scientists to do the science together with the clinicians who do the trials to really inform each other what is the state of the art in the lab and what can be translated into practice. How should we be faster in clinics? How could we adapt things that are known faster in the clinical setting? And what would be the most exciting parts also from the basic scientists to really translate quickly? And also the feedback from the clinicians where we see problems that might be quite interesting, but a drug that really works extremely well against the tumor but kills the patient is not a good drug, of course. So where are the limitations? Also from combination treatments, where are the chances? This would be a fantastic discussion between basic scientists and clinicians, but also for the whole meeting, of course, getting the cutting edge, getting the novel issues that are there and making all people familiar with that, because you've seen that we can do quite a lot in particular subgroups of patients on the tumor, though that might limit the action of other partners like surgeons. So we need to actually get together and discuss these cases more closely and set together new standards. We need the radiologists to assess. Sometimes when you use checkpoint inhibitors, the lymph nodes actually get bigger, the tumor shrinks. What does that mean? So we need a good, well-informed radiologist. We need the surgeons for maybe even more limited approaches for surgery. And we need informed clinicians. What's been done? We need to manage the side effects. And I think UEG is an ideal playground for all different specialties to get together and work out also novel strategies for subgroups of patients when you employ advanced therapeutics. And I think that might be also a think tank to think further and how can we develop our treatments, our combined multimodal treatments further in specific subgroups.
So, but what I get from our last 30 minutes speaking is that there has been a lot which was new at UEG Week 2024, and the program seems to be very informative. And I think both of us hope that a lot of our audience will actually stream the sessions from UEG Week this year, because they're very important subjects targeted, which we could only talk about briefly. And there's much more information to learn on the platform. And with respect to, say, the crosstalk between the clinician and basic researchers, I have the pleasure to all invite our audience next year to our Digestive Disease Mechanism Summit, which will especially target these questions on a very high level of basic research interacting with the clinicians. And with this, I think I would like to thank you for a wonderful talk and hope that the audience have enjoyed it. And I hope to see you back in Berlin as not only a podcast contributor, but also contributing in person. Thank you very much, Thomas, for your time, and enjoy your holidays.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.